You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Hello, great to have you along. After 12:30 today, just a little more information coming through on some of those admissions that are going into the McCarthy review into the live trade, the sheep trade into Middle Eastern parts over the Northern Hemisphere summer. Today, having a look at the Australian Veterinary Association's report and its submission to the McCarthy Review. And I should say the McCarthy Review was expecting that to be out on Friday, but the latest news on the release of that review is now maybe next week, maybe the week after, because it's going to be peer-reviewed before it's finally released. But looking at the submission from the Australian Veterinary Association today and talking to Dr. Paula Parker, she's the president of the association, her key point, well, really there are four recommendations in the report from the AVA, and the main one being that the Veterinary Association doesn't believe the sheep trade to the Middle East during the Northern Hemisphere summer should continue. There should be that pause in the middle of the year, and Dr. Parker will explain why after 12:30. Also, looking at some of the talk, some of the conversations coming out of Beef Australia 2018. This is the National Beef Expo. It's held every 3 years in Rockhampton, and there's a lot of tech talk. There's a lot of talk about future markets. We'll get to that after 12:30 today. And of course, the markets, the Katanning sheep market today, just before the news at one. But what is in it for you? What wasn't in it for you? Let me know your thoughts on the federal budget. Have you been poring over the detail today? Let me know your thoughts. 0448 922 604. The government pretty much spent the morning pitching its case to remain in power. The budget released last night, as you'd know, is expected by many to be its last before the next federal election, which is due within the year. So to find out more about what is in it for you, and especially the agricultural sector, you're off to Canberra.
Hello from Parliament House in Canberra, where community reaction to last night's budget is starting to sink in.
Yeah, I don't think the tax break, it's such a small amount of money usually that we get back in our pay packet, so, and it gets taken somewhere else. So I think they'd be better off spending it on something that really needs, like the health system. Just start ploughing money, more money into the health system.
Yeah, well, we thought the rollout of the new internet system was going to improve things, but I think it's just deteriorated, and there needs to be a hard look at improving. If we're going to keep competitive worldwide as producers, we need to have communication.
Yep. We're getting left behind, there's no doubt about that.
There was no money or plan for dealing with drought at a federal level. How do you feel about that?
Once again, they're looking at the big cities, they're not looking at the rural areas. I was talking to a friend last night who has just come back from a trip down Lawn Hill down to Winton and back, and he said it's the drought's extremely severe out there.
It's something that's really taking hold right across the country. My name is Brett Worthington. I cover rural affairs for the ABC here at Parliament. With me is my colleague, Clint Jasper. Clint, if we look at this budget from a regional perspective, it's one that needs to be viewed in two parts. There's a whole lot of money for people who live in rural areas, but then there's farming off to the side as well, and it's a mixed bag. Just to remind people, where are we sitting between those two perspectives?
I guess if you live in the country, one of the biggest items in this budget is that spending on regional health. A lot of it won't be an immediate delivery because I guess the centrepiece is this Murray-Darling Medical Schools Network, $94.5 million for that. That'll see more doctors trained in the country. It'll see less high-achieving high school students have to go to the city to actually complete a medical degree in the first place, plus more options for junior doctors to really specialise in rural medicine. There's $40 million to improve access to aged care services in the bush, and that comes as part of a suite of measures aimed at older Australians generally. And there's a lot of focus on upgrading roads, key regional corridors. I mean, these are all things that aren't, I guess, specifically targeted at regional Australians, but from which regional Australians will benefit. And then specifically for farmers, we've got this $101 million for improved biosecurity and $51 million for more trade councillors. And With us today is Tony Ma. He's the Chief Executive of the National Farmers Federation. Tony, there's been quite a reaction to what's not in the budget. We'll come to some of those biosecurity and trade measures a bit later. But we heard just then how frustrated people are at mobile black spots, how worried they are about the drying off that we're seeing across the country. How disappointing is it that the mobile black spots weren't addressed in this budget?
Look, we've been talking with the government for some time about the issues and dilemmas rural and regional people have had with mobile black spots, and it's something we won't let go of. So it is quite disappointing that there hasn't been further commitment to mobile black spot programs. I talked to the minister this morning about this, and we will continue to talk with the government to make sure that they understand the implications, and also to talk with the telcos around, you know, what barriers they're facing around investment in black spots and mobile coverage in the bush, because it is such a critical issue, not only from a social or a safety perspective, but you know the influence or impact it can have on farm business productivity as we go further down the sort of digital pathway is really something that we think will contribute to agriculture growing from $60 billion to $100 billion.
We obviously didn't hear about drought much either. Were you expecting much from the government on drought?
Drought is always going to be a piece or in the landscape of Australian agriculture. So, and we're acutely aware of some of the conditions that are facing farmers across the country as they, some of them start sowing winter crops and have just some of them finish sowing winter crops. So it's a critical issue. We know there's parts of New South Wales and Queensland that have been in drought for a number of years now. Drought policy is really challenging. It's not, from my perspective, something that any government has nailed. It's an ongoing issue, but we just can't let up. We know the challenges and the problems people are facing right now from dry and drought conditions.
I spoke to the Agriculture Minister, David Littleproud, and put these two issues to him. Let's hear what he had to say.
We've already got, since we've been in government, spent over $1 billion in support to farmers and communities. 7,900 families on farm household assistance. 2,300 of those have been on for 3 years, and we've transitioned some of those off. And we need to understand people have been self-assessing. In fact, in Queensland, more than half that are eligible haven't applied. So we've got to be smart about that, and I'm calling out for people not to self-assess. Go and see your farm financial counsellor. We've also put money into. We put money into the dog fencing, money into also the pests and weeds. So we've made strategic investments in building resilience for drought. So we'll continue to work with the agri-political groups to make sure we get the settings right and continue to work with communities, because it's not just farmers that hurt, it's also the small businesses that support those agricultural businesses.
It's not your portfolio, I appreciate it, but a data drought is often talked about, particularly in your electorate. You'd be well aware of telecommunication black spots. There doesn't seem to be a new approach to dealing with that in this budget. Is that something your government needs to do more on in this next year ahead?
Well, we were the first government to invest $220 million in a mobile phone black spot program. The biggest impediment to that continuing is the telcos themselves. The telcos need to step up, and in fact the CEOs of both Optus and Telstra have both admitted to me that they don't intend to invest in any more mobile phone black spot programs because there's no commercial incentive from them making enough profit to do so. So they need to come clean, and we need to have a look at that. But that is an impediment, and the reality is we put our money on the table, and in fact some of the telcos are still working through building some of the towers from round one and two. So the real emphasis needs to go back on the telcos to come back to the table and make that investment in regional rural Australia, not just a straight commercial one. Understand that we need the telecommunication tools of the 21st century, and we're there waiting for them to come back.
If they don't, is it something the government might have to do?
Well, look, the reality is governments don't run telecommunications business. We did years ago, and that didn't work out so well. So this is where we need to make sure we get the policy settings of getting telecommunications companies coming on that journey with us. There's a number of range of different policy settings that can be looked at, and that's something I'm sure Bridget McKenzie, as the Regional Telecommunications Minister, will be looking at.
Federal Agriculture Minister David Littleproud. Brett Worthington is my name. This is the Country Hour, and we're looking into the federal budget. With me is the ABC's Clint Jasper and Tony Ma from the National Farmers Federation. Tony, if you can deal with drought and get a crop, this budget is now designed for you because it's all about exports and biosecurity. Are you happy that they're the two big takeouts?
Well, biosecurity is the absolute foundation of food, feed and fibre production. So we absolutely have to have a strong, robust biosecurity system in Australia. So not only does it protect, you know, what we're producing here from a domestic point of view, but it underpins all of the export markets, and that's where we'll continue to see growth in the agriculture sector. So $100 million is welcomed, but it can't stop there. We've got to actually do more on this, otherwise we will get continued incursions like white spot and things like that, which will just compromise the ag sector.
On the export side of it, it's about $51 million. Industry will have to pay for about half of that. That's how agriculture works with cost recovery. Although the government says it will work with industry to work out how that might happen. Does that seem fair to you?
Look, this has been on the table for some time. It's not necessarily welcomed, but it's if we want a strong biosecurity system, there's no doubt industry has to play its part, and that means on farm, and it increasingly, unfortunately, means that we have to share some of the costs. So as long as we can get the right outcomes at the other end and we can continue to sell and grow exports, then hopefully that will work out.
Just so people can understand, there's money for these trade councillors. They work in country overseas. What do they actually do?
Yeah, they're really important, the trade council. So the extra six ag councillors, what they do is to really add some depth and colour to the free trade agreement. So the free trade agreements ultimately mean that tariffs come down or get removed, or hopefully totally removed, but there still remains some technical barriers to trade. So these can be things like testing arrangements, certification protocols that actually allow the product to get off the wharf and into the supermarket shelves, and they can be as much or more than a barrier, the tariff barriers. So it's the technical barriers that we need people in country to work with those governments to address and remedy those barriers, because they're huge. There was a bit of work done by the dairy and livestock sector that quantified them at around about $5 to $7 billion. So it's real money, and it will have a real difference.
Where would you like to see them go?
It's a good question. I think the minister announced this morning that was going to be an ag councillor in South America, and that's a developing market, so that's probably a good thing. We will have to have a look at some of the growth markets. So, you look at the traditional priority markets like China and Japan and Korea. So obviously they'll have to be in the mix there, but perhaps some of the other markets like Vietnam and Indonesia, Malaysia, some of these more developing markets perhaps. But there's no doubt these guys on the ground will make a real difference.
It's a point that the Agriculture Minister was keen to point home when I had a chat with him earlier today.
Unless we unpack the technical barriers and putting boots on the ground in those markets and putting investment into the scientific work of getting rid of those technical barriers, trade agreements don't have the value that they should.
Is the more money for biosecurity conceding that government needs to play a bigger role in this space?
On the contrary, we already are. The reality is we put $200 million extra through the Ag Competitive White Paper. This is supplementing that and making strategic investments in new technologies and different ways of looking at our biosecurity to be more efficient, to make sure we get our product out of the country quicker, and checking the stuff that comes in.
So one part of the budget is a new import levy on everything that's coming in. It's going to get about $350 million for the government. And it seems to outdo the spending that you've got. Not a little bit more you could have chipped into different parts of agriculture?
Oh, well, we'll be going back for more biosecurity measures. This is the first tranche. We had the CRAIC review that had 42 recommendations, and one of those recommendations was a container levy. But we need to implement the investment in biosecurity in a sensible way, in a staged way, that makes sure it gets the best bang for buck, but continues on that journey of getting the best efficiencies in terms of the capital investment.
So the Agriculture Minister, David Littleproud, says more to come on how all this money that they're going to be getting from that import levy will be spent. Tony Maher, in short, what does your group, the National Farmers Federation, want to see happening next?
We want to see this money make a difference. And as I said, those ag councillors, get them into country and get them addressing some of these non-tariff barriers. We want to see the rollout of the biosecurity money and make sure that the system is sound and robust here. And we want to continue talking with the government about mobile black spots and drought. This is a real critical issue for the ag sector right now. So we've got a good relationship with the minister, and we'll be talking to him about what measures we can look at to try and address some of the concerns. So it's game on now, and continuing to advocate for rural and regional Australia and the farmers of Australia.
Clint Jasper, we come to this from a reporting point of view. What else will we be keeping an eye on?
how the rest of that money is spent in the biosecurity space, where it's allocated, and really at some point the government's going to need to address telecommunications in a meaningful way, and because of the nature of the problem, to really address it in a way that's going to truly satisfy people in regional Australia. It's going to be a big ticket item and it's probably going to be expensive.
And so this budget comes on top of what we've seen in the last week. We've seen a Murray-Darling deal, which is going to have new money going into it, which the government needs to fund. We've got a review into the live export industry due out in the matter of weeks. It's going to shape what happens in that, in the sheep trade, in the weeks and then months and years ahead. This is without even mentioning a wool review that's currently underway into Australian wool innovation. So what is clear about what's coming out of here in Canberra is that while the budget is out there, there's still a whole lot of agricultural news that's going to be coming out of this place in the weeks and months ahead. For now, though, my name is Brett Worthington. That's all we've got from Parliament House in Canberra. Let's head back to the Country Hour.
Have your say on the Country Hour. SMS the program on 0448 922 604.
And for more federal budget coverage, particularly the details for farmers, you can head to ABC Rural's homepage in your search engine, ABC Rural, and it comes up straight away. I've done it before. I've just done it here in the studio. It works every time. 21 past 12, ABC WA. Harvey Giblett, he grows fruit in Manjimup in the state's southwest region. Harvey, you are WA's second largest apple grower. What are your thoughts on last night's federal budget?
Is it Belinda?
It is. Hi, Harvey.
Hi, Belinda. The biosecurity one is a good one. My belief is both state and federal governments, that's part of their core business, is biosecurity for Australia, to protect our borders and incursion of pests and diseases. But also recognise that industry also needs to have some skin in the game too, to make sure that they're fair dinkum about actually wanting that protection from biosecurity. So I think it's welcome, and I think biosecurity goes hand in hand with our export expectations as well, because market access is a big component for our industry particularly. And to compete, we need biosecurity and market access requirements working hand in hand.
Now, the Treasurer announced the government's committing that $51.3 million over the next 4 years for new agricultural trade councillors. As we've just been listening to from the coverage from Parliament House, there'll be six new positions in new markets, an extension of positions in Vietnam, Malaysia, the Middle East, China, and Thailand, and agricultural trade councillors, as we just heard, sort of keep an eye on things at that end once the product gets in. So any technicalities, those sort of issues, they can iron those out and sort of get product on shelf in supermarkets at the other end much quicker, sort of sorting out those sort of details. Now, Harvey, you export some fruit overseas. So what's your reaction to this sort of spending, the $51.3 million over the next 4 years for these trade councillors?
I think it's very pleasing because obviously, and I can speak for our industry in as much as that we're desperately trying to increase exports out of Australia, and certainly market access is the biggest impediment, particularly into Southeast Asia, China, and hopefully eventually Japan. They are markets where we need to target because there's a lot of premium end opportunities in those markets, and that's also what we need from Australia. We're high cost producers, we're very clean and good at what we do, but it also comes at a price. So to be competitive, we need those market accesses to the premium end of those markets, and I believe there's plenty of opportunities there for us, particularly with our high-end apple varieties like Pink Lady and Bravo. There's excellent opportunities to access those markets once we get the protocol right.
You're knocking on the door. How much would you like to increase the exports to those markets?
Oh, there's pretty much a very low percentage at this point in time, Belinda. So, you know, we're really starting almost from scratch in those markets. So, and we're working closely with government agency and Commonwealth agencies with getting market access. and the protocols for the requirements for those countries to get entry into those markets. So that's already happening. So any money that's spent at that end that helps us, get access to those markets has got to be a plus.
So what's your plan then? If you look ahead 5, 10 years, how much would you like to be exporting? How many apples?
Australia's a fairly small producer of apples, but we're pretty wholly supplying our domestic market at this point in time, and there are a number of growers leaving the industry because that's too hard to just make one market work. So we really desperately need another market access, and exports obviously offers that opportunity. And I think once we get a market access, then we've got a chance to regrow our industry to a level where it's sustainable.
Harvey Giblett, you mentioned earlier that you welcomed that spend on biosecurity in the budget last night, the announcement of $101.6 million being spent on over 4 years on things like detection technology, improved pest and disease incursion response plans, and better screening of imported foods. So you like that spend, but the industry has to play its role and spend a little too. And you mentioned earlier having skin in the game. So you welcome that. You're happy to put your hand in your pocket for that.
Oh, absolutely. And our apple industry here in Western Australia has got a biosecurity fund. We're very fortunate in WA. We have an APC. And we've got a home fruit committee, and part of that is fee-for-service. We're able to raise fee and put some of that fee-for-service aside into a biosecurity fund. So we're topping that fund up, and we want to build that up to a substantial fund so that if we have an incursion of a pest that we don't have here, and particularly in Western Australia, that we're able to help with the control and hopefully eradication of that.
27 past 12. A few things not in the budget last night, Harvey Giblett. One, no new funding for mobile black spots. Also, the Southern Forest Irrigation Scheme, which is being developed for agricultural irrigation in the Manjimup Pemberton area of the southwest of the state. Still nothing there. Is it ever going to get off the ground?
Oh, most definitely, Belinda. We just see this as a bit of an aberration. Disappointing, of course. You've got to be fair about that. But we've got a very, very good scheme here that we totally believe in. We've got a state government that's continues to back the scheme. We've got stakeholders who have oversubscribed in water sales to the scheme. So, and we've got engineering happening now on the pipe route for the scheme. So, we're very, very committed to the scheme. This is an aberration, but I've had a whole lifetime of living on the edge with water supply. So water security is very much at the top of my agenda. I'm very passionate about it, and I won't be happy until such time as we've got the scheme up and running.
Harvey, thank you so much for just casting an eye over the federal budget, what it means for you and the broader industry. Really good to talk to you on the Country Hour this afternoon. 28 past 12, ABC WA, Belinda Varaschetti with you. That's Harvey Giblett, a fruit grower, mainly apple grower in the southwest of the state in Manjimup. Just speaking of the Southern Forest Irrigation Scheme, on our WA Country Hour Facebook page, Peter says, I think the Southern Forest Irrigation Scheme is just a pipe dream. You can be part of that conversation on Facebook or the text 0448 922 604. Well, farmers' bottom lines haven't fared too badly in this year's federal budget. Jeff Hall from rural accounting specialist RSM Bird Cameron has been going over the details for you, and his conclusion is it's a very responsible budget. He says with some good savings coming from the previous budget, last year's budget, and an election looming, primary producers have been dangled a few carrots, and there may be more to come over the next couple of months.
Well, I think it's reasonably positive without there being too many negatives in there at all, and not rash positives, or if you could call them rash, but seems like a pre-election budget, but structured in a way that maybe they've got a fair bit up their sleeve to offer during the election campaign.
Do you think as a result of the measures that have been announced so far, farmers' pockets will be heavier or lighter?
I think there's some good stuff in the budget, particularly in regard to their seven-year tax plan. That's broken into three parts, which includes tax relief, where the maximum tax relief is $530 per annum. And that means, say, for a farming family of four, that's over $2,000. So that's quite significant. They're talking about addressing bracket creep, and they're moving the tax threshold, the 32.5 tax threshold, from $87,000 to $90,000. That'll have a slight compound effect for farmers who are taxed through the income averaging system as well. So I think that's beneficial. The other important announcement I think that will help a lot of farmers is the imputation credit refunds will remain. And I think that does help farmers who live out and have, you know, high incomes and low incomes and sometimes big losses, and they can recoup some of their tax paid through companies through refunds from imputation credits through their companies. And they've still got in their policy that they intend to reduce the company tax rate from 27.5% to 25% within the next 10 years.
They just haven't done it yet.
No, well, they're having difficulty getting that one through the Senate. There's some minor things that would be beneficial to a lot of farmers out there. For instance, self-managed superannuation funds up till now have a maximum membership of four. You can't have more than four members. And from the 1st of July 2019, it's going to six members. So that might be quite helpful for larger farming families. The only other change was that if you've had a good record of maintaining your self-managed super fund, you can have an audit every 3 years instead of every year, which is a bit of a saving for those people. One other thing that might apply to a lot of farmers is that there's a $10,000 subsidy for employing over 50-year-olds that's coming into play. And that might be quite useful in country areas where there's a bit of a shortage of good employees.
Jeff Hall, he's the Director of Business Advisory at Rural Accounting Specialist, RSM Bird Cameron, catching up there with the ABC's Tara de Landgraft. 28 to 1, time to get headlines, and Michaela Carr in the studio with those. Hello.
Hi, Belle. The dual citizenship saga has taken another turn with four federal by-elections set to take place. Labor MPs Susan Lamb, Justine Kay and Josh Wilson, as well as crossbencher Rebecca Sharkey, all announcing their resignations today. The Treasurer, Scott Morrison, says the tax package included in last night's federal budget must be passed by July the 1st, or the first round of tax cuts for low to middle income earners won't apply. The cuts are worth up to $530 a year for about 10 million workers. The WA Police Commissioner, Chris Dawson, says a criminal investigation is underway into the former Labor member for Darling Range, Barry Urban. Mr Urban resigned yesterday, minutes after a state parliamentary committee recommended he be expelled after deliberately misleading over his police service and education. And Fremantle veteran David Mundy insists Sunday's poor showing against Richmond was an aberration. And the Dockers are on the improve. The Dockers went down by 77 points in their biggest loss of the season. Big day today. So much news today, all coming out of Canberra. So stay tuned. I think it'll develop as the day goes on.
Oh, the budget, the dual citizenship the Dockers. Do you think they're on the improve?
I think they are. I don't know what happened on the weekend, but I'd like to see them do well.
All right. We'll watch this space. Thank you, Michaela. ABC WA, 27 to 1. This is the Country Hour. And still to come, catching up with Dr. Paula Parker. She's the president of the Australian Veterinary Association, and the association just sort of signing off on its report to the McCarthy Review into the sheep trade into the Middle East. And the association saying that its recommendation, four key recommendations, the big one being that it believes in a suspension of sheep exports to the Middle East during the Northern Hemisphere summer, and that has been put under the nose of the vet, Dr. McCarthy, who is to conduct that review, and we expect those results, well, next week, the week after, not sure yet. Off to the Weather Bureau, and Noel Pusey has the details. And Noel, let's start where we always do. You know the drill, northern and eastern parts of the state.
Oh, I was going to mix it up a bit and just ask if you're going to ask it. No, that's all right. That's all right. No, there's very, very little happening at the moment. Fairly mild and balmy conditions over much of the state, really. A weak cold front along the south coast at the moment. Excuse me, but a ridge developing in the wake of that, but generally dry easterly winds over the northern half of the state, little in the way of weather at all for the next few days, so remaining dry right through until at least Sunday in the north and also over most eastern parts as well. If I then brush down to the south land division for the next little bit, we have a weak cold front along the south coast. There's some light shower activity from Cape Lewin all the way to Israelite Bay at the moment, possibly pushing a little bit towards the southern parts of the Great Southern, but only very light falls expected there. And during this evening, the shower activity will extend to the Euclid Coast as well. And from the eastern southeast coastal district to the Euclid Coast tomorrow morning, there's a chance of some morning showers through there and also for the next day or two as well, just along that Euclid Coast, through probably until clearing on Sunday. But the main feature being a very large high-pressure system developing south of the state, a long way south of the state, during Thursday and then into Friday, and we'll see a general easterly winds and a warming trend over much of the state. In fact, temperatures near the west coast by Friday and Saturday getting close to near record highs this time of the year. So Perth looking around about 30 degrees for Friday. So quite warm, and but very dry, and unfortunately not very much in the way of season-breaking rains at all on the horizon for the next week or so.
No, that's most unfortunate. And any warnings today, Noel?
The only warning, strong wind warning for coastal waters on the North Kimberley coast, really from the NT border towards Cullumbaroo up there for tomorrow.
Good to catch up. Thank you for the details, Noel. 24 to 1. ABC WA, this is the Country Hour. News at 1. Just before the news today, the results of the Katanning sheep market today. Tracy, along with those details for you. And also taking you off to Beef Australia 2018. This is the big beef expo. Only comes around every three years in Rockhampton. So getting all the detail for you, what's keeping everyone talking at Beef Australia 2018 very shortly for you. Well, still more talk about the Southern Forest Irrigation Scheme. Just talking to Harvey Giblett, the fruit grower in the southwest of the state, about this and the fact that there wasn't any money in it for that scheme coming out of the federal budget announcement last night. This through on the text, which is 0448 922 604. Now that the Southern Forest Irrigation Scheme is off the table, hopefully the Department of Water and Environmental Regulation will now remove the moratorium imposed on self-supply water users and get back to managing water supplies, hopefully giving access to more water and therefore having no need for the pipeline scheme. Let me know your thoughts on that or anything else that pops up during the Country Hour today. It'd be great to hear from you. 22 to 1. No rainfall, just a quick mention too, in the northern and eastern districts, but in the southwest of the state, three of note. The southwest, Walpole Forestry 12, Windy Harbour 6, and in the southern coastal region, Barrett Meadows had 7. The Australian Veterinary Association says the best way forward for the live animal export trade is to impose a suspension of sheep exports to the Middle East during the Northern Hemisphere summer. That is one of the key findings or recommendations in the AVA's submission to the McCarthy Review into the sheep trade, which is due next week, maybe the week after. Dr. Paula Parker is the president of the AVA. Paula Parker, how did the association come to this conclusion?
What our remit and our feed into the McCarthy Review was to look at all of the evidence as it applies to stocking density and as it applies to the heat stress model in sheep. So I've looked at the available scientific evidence and the reports on previous vessels, and that's informed, I guess, the recommendations in our review about making stocking density aligned to what we call allometric principles. So there's a calculation that you use for each sheep based on their weight, and then also about the difficulties, particularly in that climate, about managing heat stress. And I guess what we find with heat stress is that the effects are cumulative. So just like us, animals can experience a heat stress event and they can cope with it to a certain point. And it depends on the duration of that heat stress event and then whether they get a temperature relief as to whether that goes on to have kind of longer term consequences. And what the evidence shows for vessels during that period is that we can have cumulative heat loads that the animals aren't recovering from. And sometimes, even when the temperature does drop slightly, we don't see them having a recovery from that heat stress event.
So you've concluded that nothing can be done in terms of stocking density, ventilation, food and water supply that would really make a difference at this particular time of the year, the northern summer?
I think it's incredibly challenging. So they're the things that you look at. So you look at stocking density, you look at ventilation and manipulating feed and water and how the animals are housed. But the real challenge is about the interaction between temperature and humidity on those vessels. And to date, none of the levers that have been able to pull have been able to get that to a point where the animals are able to cope with the heat load.
How can you be sure, though? Because, I mean, have you gone through every one of these ships? Because some of them are quite different when you compare one to the other.
Yeah, so every ship is slightly different. And what we've gone through is the evidence about heat stress from a physiological point of view from the sheep. And I guess from that perspective, from the available scientific evidence is what we can kind of make an assessment on, because that's our remit, is that we can't recommend a method to reduce that.
The livestock vessel, the Mesura, arrived on the north coast of Turkey just last weekend. It had over 70,000 sheep on board and losses were under 0.5%, so over 99.5% success story, I suppose you could say. So this delivery, made in that period that the AVA says shouldn't be allowed, that's May through to October, but doesn't that particular shipment then prove that it can be done successfully?
There are two things that we try and look at as it applies to the live export vessels. And so at the moment, the indicator is about mortality, and it's good to see that there's a mortality under 0.5%. Currently, the reportable mortality for sheep is 2%, and we'd like to see that reduced as part of the ASIL standards. One of the other things that we look at is about the welfare of the sheep and what we call their morbidity, so how they're coping with the voyage. That's something that's not currently able to be collected very well in the data that we have, which is reported at the moment. And so it's about, are the sheep experience a significant stress during that voyage in terms of their heat stress, and what we can do to reduce that.
There have been so many successful voyages that meet the standards and the requirements over the years since this trade began. Is the Australian Veterinary Association's conclusion based on worst-case scenarios rather than considering all the successful voyages that have gone to this region in years gone by?
I think what we are striving to do is to work for kind of continuous long-term improvement in these areas. But our job is also to be honest about, OK, where our current scientific evidence says about their ability to cope with heat stress in these spots, and that it is really challenging for us to be able to say, okay, based on the scientific evidence, that they can, at a reduced stocking density, not suffer heat stress during that period. And so it's a matter of, okay, if we're ensuring the welfare of animals on board and also the welfare of the animals right through the supply chain, what changes can be made to try and mitigate those risks? And shifting away from that period is one of those things. But we're also mindful that sudden changes don't benefit the animals in the rest of the supply chain as well. So we've got to try and be considered and evidence-based about how we go about these things.
On ABC WA, this is The Country Hour. Belinda Varaschetti with you, and you're listening to Dr. Paula Parker. She's the president of the Australian Veterinary Association, and the association has released a review into the live sheep trade into the Middle East over the northern summer. And one of the key recommendations is a suspension of that trade during that time of the year. Dr. Parker, who commissioned the AVA's review and who paid for it?
So it's something that the AVA's done on our behalf, that we have put submissions and we will put submissions into each of the reviews. So it was written by AVA members and AVA staff looking through all of the evidence.
Okay, so there was no exchange of money to do the report. It was just something that you took on internally?
Yes.
Yeah. Your position supports the State Agriculture Minister, Alana McTiernan's position on sheep exports to the Middle East during this period. She's also suggested this week that maybe air freighting the sheep during the northern summer would be a good alternative. Would the AVA support that?
I think our concern with any transport is ensuring the welfare of the animals during that transport phase. And so it would depend on what provisions are in place for the air freight of sheep. Our concern would be around, okay, how are the welfare of the sheep looked after in under that construct, and currently there isn't an Australian standard that looks at that.
How many of the association's 9,500 members agree with the AVA's stance on the live trade of sheep to the Middle East in the northern summer?
Yeah.
Do you speak for all of those? Because some of these vets are on these vessels going to the Middle East during this period of time.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a kind of diversity of views about the specifics, but one of the things that we all agree on is the most important priority is the welfare of the animals on board these vessels. And so there are a number of changes that we want to see to be put in place that looks after the welfare of the sheep. And we go through a consultation process as we're building these things to, you know, discuss that with all of our members. And some of them do have differing views about the specifics, but that what they all agree about is the primary principle of, through which we export livestock is that the welfare of the animals should be the most important consideration, and all of our members agree with that.
Dr. Michael McCarthy's been appointed by the Federal Agriculture Minister David Littleproud to review the trade, and that review now due next week because it's going to be peer-reviewed before release. Is he a member of your association?
I'm not 100% sure at this point in time. I know he has been in the past, so I'm not sure if he's a financial member at this very point in time, but he has been a member of the past, and I guess we regard him as a member of our profession, whether he's a financial member or not.
Is this review that the AVA has released your way of putting pressure on him to support the AVA's position?
What our aim was really was to kind of put that into his review so that we've done the literature review part. It takes a lot of time and resources, obviously, to go through that literature. So our goal was to present to him the literature review of those aspects of the literature that have been looked at by some of his peers. But he has a mandate to look through all of the different things and then factor that into what he presents to the government.
Okay, so we could assume his review will include a recommendation for the suspension of the trade in the northern summer?
I think that's probably too early to assume that that's what he's going to say. We've certainly highlighted the challenges with heat stress during that period of the trade, and his advice is going to be to government to say, okay, what do we do with this concern about heat stress? So at this stage, we're not sure what his review is going to say and the recommendations that he's going to give.
Dr. Parker, really good to get your insights and just to go through the details of your review. Thank you.
No worries. Thank you.
Dr. Paula Parker, President of the Australian Veterinary Association.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on The Country Hour on ABC Local Radio, WA.
And just wanted to let you know that Tony York, the president of the one of the state's farm lobby groups, WA Farmers, is over in Canberra. I think tomorrow will be his third day there, just knocking on the politicians' doors with a few others and just talking, letting them know the industry perspective on the future of the live export trade. So catching up with him on the program around about this time tomorrow and just to get a feel for what the politicians have been telling him, how long this issue might be an issue for the industry going forward. The market results, the Katanning sheep market, not far away. Tracy Kilner with the details for you shortly. First, though, there's been a huge focus on upcoming tech advances and future trade deals at Beef Australia 2018. This is the big one, the National Beef Expo, and it's held every 3 years in Rockhampton in Queensland. Amy McCosker is there and has this report for you.
With drones, they can get to like 74 kilometres an hour and they cover so much distance so quick, and it's all over the touch of a button at home, so it's really good. And yeah, same with the ear tagging program they got now, where you can look on your tablet computer and you know exactly where your cattle are in the exact like paddock, so it's really good.
Jack Heyman is in grade 12 at St Brendan's College, and he's not the only one excited by the flash new tech at Beef 2018. The queues to test out new crushers, virtual reality farm tours, and the latest in drones need to be seen to be believed. According to futurist Chris Riddell, this thirst for the latest and greatest could see digital disruption become a problem down the track.
We all remember Blockbuster being around and going and hiring a DVD. And Farah, I mean, I'm 37, so I feel that I'm not that old yet. But I remember in my 20s going to Blockbuster. When I arrived here in Australia 10 years ago, Blockbuster still existed. And I went in there with my partner at the time, and we'd hire out movies for the weekend. Then suddenly, overnight, Netflix came in, and nobody saw the enormous impact that was going to have to Blockbuster. And now they've disappeared completely in just a couple of years. And I think everyone just assumed that because Blockbuster was there a couple of years ago, they would stay around and they'd be fine. People would always want to hire DVDs, and how wrong they got it. And the message for all of us is here: don't think you're the incumbent and you're the only one that's going to ever be around, because somebody will come in and try and disrupt you and flip your industry and try and do things better. And digital disruption isn't just about creating an app or making a website or going on social media. It's about fundamentally challenging everything you do in your business. For instance, if you're a farmer, everything you've been doing through all the generations, challenging yourselves and going, is that the best way to do it today?
Colin Woodall is the Vice President of Government Affairs for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association of America. He says the potential of digital disruption adds to the constantly changing marketplace for beef internationally.
When you're talking about disruption, I think the biggest disruption we're seeing right now, of course, is our president, President Trump, because trade is such an important part of our business in the United States. Even though we only export about 15% of our total production, that equates to about $300 in additional value to each marketed animal. That's significant to any producer, regardless of where you're at. So to see the disruption that we have seen through the president pulling us out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, renegotiation of NAFTA, renegotiation of the South Korean agreement, it has been really challenging for us to try to figure out where we're ultimately going to end up. Because if we have to keep a lot of that production domestically, it means prices are going to go down for our producers, and that's not what we want.
So what's next? Mr. Woodall says it's hard to know.
We haven't quite seen the impact yet. I think as we continue to see 2018 play out, we'll see some more actual impact and harm that we can put a money value, a monetary value towards. But right now, we look at where we were a year ago, and we can't say that we're worse off. Now, I think we're going to see that change. But if we just look at NAFTA, for example, even though his action to renegotiate NAFTA is one that has caused a tremendous amount of consternation among all of us in agriculture, we understand that he is getting very close to a final deal. And our request to him was not to engage or change the live cattle exports or the beef export provisions. And he respected that. So if he comes out with a deal that might be better for American automobiles, but protects agriculture, then we might look back and say we were worried for nothing at all.
But all of this might not be front of mind for those punters who are just enjoying doing a bit of tire kicking at Beef Australia.
It's really good because it cuts the hard work out, and it makes it easier for farmers to be able to look after their property, after their stock, make sure they got water, feed, you know. If there's a cattle down somewhere, they can see it on their drone. They know they can go check it out, like if it's bogged or if something happens to it. So it's really good.
So if we're in a world where people can look at their screen and see exactly where their cows are, and they can fly drones out and check fences, and they can look at their screen and see their electric fences, I mean, what could possibly be next? I mean, where do we go?
I really don't know. It's interesting to know what's coming up for us. But yeah, it's real cool. It's still the hard work's there, but actually finding the problems are coming a lot easier for farmers.
8 to 1, that's Tech Fanatic Jack Heyman from St. Brendan's College, ending Amy McCosker's report. It's all online. Just put ABC Rural in your search engine. You'll make your way there and learn more about that. Tech advances, disruptions to it, all at Beef Australia this year. ABC WA 7 to 1. Well, if you love a glass of freshly squeezed orange juice and you love to know that you're drinking homegrown WA fruit, well, you are in luck. One of the state's biggest orange growers in the state's $27 million citrus industry has begun its 2018 harvest. Mora Citrus is picking about 2 weeks early this year, and sales and distribution manager Damien Guthrie says it's been a good season for growing large fruit.
The fruit's looking really good this year. We're probably about 2 weeks earlier than we were about this time last year. The fruit size, we're probably a little bit bigger year on year as well. And the thing that's been really in our favour over the months of April and March has been the warm days. So a lot of those warm days have really allowed the sugars in the fruit to develop. So we're seeing some pretty good eating quality come off the orchard at the moment.
That's pretty satisfying, I imagine.
Yes.
How many tonnes of fruit are you expecting to pick this year?
Our expectation is we'll pick around 8,000 tonnes. Our increases, we've got much significantly improved mandarin crops. The orange crop is probably on par with last year, but we'll definitely see more mandarins coming off the property just as a result of, you know, we've got some young plantings up there, and as the trees mature, there'll be more volume coming off.
Damien, my understanding is that you've been picking and you're about to send a load of fruit, or you've sent a load of fruit to Perth. Where are you at?
Yeah, so we sent out first load of fruit down last night. We've got into the market this morning. So that'll be going out and hitting retailer shelves this afternoon. So that was the first load of oranges that we've picked from Mora.
And what sort of prices are you expecting for that early crop?
Generally, you know, the pricing always kicks off high, well, towards the higher levels, you know, just because it takes us a while to get the volume off the orchard. And then as we progress in the season, we sort of hit our peak production month during the months of July, August and September. So that's when you'll see the most competitive prices at the retail level. And then as we get into the later the seasons and the volumes start to drop off again, that's when we'll see the price start to rise again.
Are you expecting the amount of fruit that you're sending overseas to increase this year?
We're expecting, you know, with very much on par volumes of oranges from 2017, we'd expect our export and domestic splits to remain the same. I think this year with the new packing shed and some other third-party growers coming into the mix as well, we'll send some mandarins, we'll trial some mandarins overseas, and we might trial some more of the red flesh Karakara navels, which are a mid-season navel.
Damien Guthrie from Mora Citrus with the ABC's Joe Prendergast. And if you want to buy WA fruit, most of the citrus growers put a sticker on the fruit, clearly labelling it as WA grown. So watch out for that if you're keen to support the local industry. 4 minutes to 1 o'clock. It's market time here on the Country Hour, and almost 29,000 sheep sold at last week's Katanning sale. That was a pretty large yarding. Tracy Kilner, how did today's sale go?
Hi, Belinda. Our numbers were down. We had 20,590 mixed quality sheep. The yarding was dominated by lambs, with the prices up on the killable medium weight lambs and easier on stores due to the lack of pastures. The top pen of extra heavy lambs reached $150 a head to restockers and $140 to the processors. The mutton prices eased, with the ewe weights offered lighter this week. A pen of heavy ewes with a full fleece sold to a top of $125 a head to top the ewe categories. Generally, prices reflected quality offered. The lightweight lambs made from $35 to $105. Air freight lambs sold from $100 to $111. Trade weight lambs made from $129 to $137 a head. And the heavyweight lambs sold to $150. Store lambs made from $10 for plain lambs to $106 for the heavier good-framed lambs to feedlot buyers. Young black tag ewes remained firm on quality, selling to butchers from $40 to $110, depending on weights. The stores eased on quality, making from $43 to $80, depending on frame. The lightweight mutton boners sold from $10 to $75. Trade mutton made from $66 to $100 with a fleece, while the heavy mutton eased, selling from $91 to $125 a head for heavy ewes with a fleece. Young wethers fell on quality, selling from $51 to $127 a head to processors, while restocker and feeder buyers paid $40 to $91 a head. Live export was in operation today, paying from $85 to $105 for the young wethers. All our mature wethers sold to processors for $60 to $139 a head. The older slaughter rams made from $2 up to $90 to processors and $20 to $88 to restockers. Ram lambs sold from $20 to $97 to processors and feeder buyers and $78 to live export. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you for that, Tracy. A minute and a half away from the news at one. A couple of you have some really strong views on the Southern Forest Irrigation Scheme. On text, Peter, actually it's not Peter, it's Gary. Gary says, Peter is onto it, referring to an earlier text. the Southern Forest Irrigation Scheme, engineering money would be better spent studying the negative impacts on the self-funded, self-sustainable water users that the water will be taken off. In a drying climate, as they say it, it is would be better to leave things as they are rather than jeopardise the security of the area the water is coming from. There's plenty of land for sale with water for people to buy, like has always been the case, and the taxpayer can keep their money for the many shortfalls that exist. Plant what your farm can sustain and these problems won't exist to need this Southern Forest Irrigation Scheme. Thank you, Gary. This through from Pat in Pemberton. The Waters and Rivers Corp should be more vigilant as its policy of allowing farm dams without proper assessment is resulting in the destruction of creeks and wetlands in the southwest by some greedy and non-thinking landowners. This has gone on for too long, says Pat. Thank you for those texts. Appreciate that, and maybe we'll have a look into that Southern Forest Irrigation Scheme. It came up today because it wasn't in the federal budget, and just getting Harvey Giblets, the fruit grower's perspective on that earlier in the hour. Time for the news now. It's 1 o'clock.